Welcome to the Script and Style Show, the web show where we talk about web development with the people that make it happen. Today's episode is brought to you by TrackJS JavaScript Error Monitoring. Know when errors hit your website with the context to find and fix bugs fast with TrackJS. Start your free trial today at TrackJS.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Script and Style Show, the show where we talk about web development and the personalities that build it. I'm Todd Gardner from TrackJS JavaScript Error Monitoring, and my co-host David Walsh, creator of the popular blog DavidWalsh.name. David, how's it going?
I'm pretty good, man. How are you? You're fresh off of a spring break vacation. Feeling good?
Yeah, I'm a little bit tanner, I think, although I think these lights might, you know, blend that out. Spent a week out in Palm Springs, away from the snow, which was excellent. How are things going at in Mozilla land?
Things are good. Mozilla celebrates 20 years on Saturday, which is incredible, incredible number. And I'm working on redesigning the breakpoint panel within the debugger dev tool, which is super exciting. When I look at it now, it's not informative enough, right? And so we put together some suggestions and it looks really, really cool. So I'm building that out right now. And I may as well give a plug that if you want to help us with the debugger in any way, you can go to github.com/devtools.html/debugger.html and you can help us build the new debugger, which is written in React and front-end technologies. We'd love your help.
That's awesome, man. Can't wait to see it. When do you expect it's going to come out?
Oh, I got my bosses asking me that question. You can't ask me that, too. Hopefully, by the end of next week, I have it all, like, code complete. But, of course, the big thing that I'm excited about the UI, but what do you need to do with that? You need to add tests, right? And we'll be talking about tests in a moment, but hopefully very soon.
Awesome. So what are we talking about today?
So today I thought it would be a fun idea to do a little QA where we can let some of our listeners ask us questions about our experiences in the industry, about certain technical topics. And I thought that'd be good. I thought that'd be cool. And we got some really good questions, so I'm really excited to get started.
Yeah, we have a few questions lined up for today. If you have some more questions and you're watching live, feel free to drop it in live chat. If you're not fortunate enough to be watching live, feel free to hit us up on Twitter and maybe we'll answer your questions the next time. So what do we have up first?
All right. So the first thing that I wanted to we were asked, I should say, were our thoughts on the array.flatten controversy. Is that the right word?
Oh, it's something, all right. So for those of you who might not be aware, the TC39, the group that establishes standards for the JavaScript language, recently introduced a potential extension to the language for array.flatten, which would take an array of arrays and reduce the nesting down, which is something that a very popular third-party library has already done for some time. That library being?
MooTools for the win.
And so MooTools saw this need quite some time ago and had monkey patched right on top of array to add this function. Now, the concern is that the spec had not previously defined an array.flatten. And so the spec is like, that array.flatten should be undefined. And if all of a sudden is that going to create some conflicts with the very popular library? And maybe should they emulate the functionality? Because the proposed standard of what array.flatten should be is different slightly, not slightly, it's different than what MooTools did. Or should they call it something else? And there have been a number of very funny possible ideas of what to call it, including possibly Smoosh, which is a terrible, terrible name. Like, it means all kinds of terrible things in different contexts. So it should definitely, regardless, it should not be called Smoosh. But it's an open debate on what to do with this thing.
So I can, one thing that I feel a little bit defensive when it comes to MooTools. So I'm going to just mention something. So we have to remember that when MooTools started doing this, this was back in like the IE6 days, right? When browsers had, and to some degree, JavaScript had sort of been dormant for a long time, right? And so MooTools started adding these methods to prototypes because we thought they should be there. This is something that we should have, and we can't rely on browser vendors to implement this stuff because they haven't been doing this for us for a while. So that's, I think that that's really important background. Now, I'm actually going to, I'm going to assert this, right? I don't think that a Java, I don't think that any programming language should adjust itself to a given framework that's been available. I just don't believe in that, right? The language is the language, and I don't think that it should be dodging things, right? So I have no problem with the implementers calling it Flatten. And if people need to update their library or update the version of the library, then they have to do that. Like, I have no problem with that at all. What I do have the problem with is the reduction part. I don't like it. Like you said, MooTools flattens things recursively, right? I very much like that when it comes to flattening. I don't like the reduce part. One thing that you could do, I guess, is you could add a second parameter of either true or false if you want it to be done recursively, sort of like...
or just a numeric of depth.
Clone, yeah, or right. And if it's zero or something, well, I don't know if that would work, but like... That's my take on it, right? Like, you can't hate on MooTools for having put something there, even though maybe it could have been done better. But I also don't like the core. Like, I don't like what it's trying to do. Like, what do you think?
I agree. It's hard to with the time MooTools came out. Like you said, it was a different time. There was a different things that people thought were important, and so I don't fault them at all. In today's JavaScript, the idea of patching stuff onto prototype is probably not a good idea, and you probably shouldn't do it anymore. But there were all kinds of valid reasons to do it at the time, and so it's okay. I can't, you know, I'm not going to talk any crap about them. I also agree that I don't think the language, the TC39, should give a shit about what MooTools did. I think they should, you know, just come out, and if they think that it should be array.flatten, they should take array.flatten, and that's fine. And if MooTools had appropriately patched on top of it, then there shouldn't be any issues at all. And I also agree that it shouldn't, like, that I think MooTools' implementation of what Flatten did, in that it flattened infinitely recursive down the line, was correct. Especially given that the name of the method that we're talking about is Flatten. Not reduce by one.
Right.
If you want to have the default be reduce by one, then call it reduce nesting by one. But it's called flatten. So flatten that son of a bitch. Just smash it down. It should be one level when we're done, or it's not flattening it.
I completely agree. This is weird. I thought we were going to fight on this one, but it turned out that we're on the same page here.
No, I think you're... I'm a little bit more angsty about the idea of patching on a prototype, but other than that, I think we're in agreement.
I don't think we're ever going to agree on that. All right, let's hit up question number two. That was actually a really good first question to start off with.
Yeah. So question number two comes from one of our fans, D Developer R. Him and I were tweeting a couple weeks ago when we first put together this idea. He's been listening to the show for a while. And he put this question to us that this is a developer who's entering from the database administrator side, where he'd been working for 8 years. And he wanted to know our thoughts on test-driven development and behavior-driven development in the JavaScript world. And to know what we thought about that. So I guess,
first of all, I think it's really cool that one of his first questions about the front end is testing, because for me, like, testing was always the last thing I ever thought about on the front end. Right. And that was for a variety of reasons. Number one, testing on the front end has always been kind of hard, right? So you don't have control over the environment. Sometimes, I'm not hating on Selenium, but Selenium can act up on you. I just think it's really cool that someone from the back end asked that question right away, when most front end developers I know are just happy to get something to work.
I think that is emblematic of somebody coming from like the DBA side, though, is that they want more safety, more control than the web has historically given you.
Right.
And testing is a way to get some of that safety. Before we dive too deep into this, I think we just owe ourselves to introduce some of the terms that maybe not everybody's familiar with.
Sure.
TDD stands for test-driven development, and it's a concept that came out of the agile software development community and extreme programming before that. And it's the idea that you're going to start by writing your test first, and you build a test, the test fails, and then you implement just enough code to make that test pass. And you use that as a development cycle to create code that is well-tested and well-formed. Behavior-driven development is very similar in the JavaScript space. It has been implemented mainly in the fact that you're going to build integration tests that exercise that code, that exercise the code pass, and you describe your tests using a syntax that describes, like, I'm going to describe my module. My module should do this. And then the test is written in a language that is like fluently describing the behavior, so that you can read the tests almost as a story that describes the behavior of your software. Does that match what your understanding of those terms?
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that's cool about being old is that I've seen a ton of testing tools like come and go. Dojos was the most, I don't want to say outrageous because it was awesome, but they had something called the Do Robot, which was a Java applet that created real events that like moved your mouse around for you to click on things and do stuff like that. That's been really cool. But right now, one example that I would have for the debuggers that we use Jest and Mochi tests, and those are just a few of the tools, but what are your thoughts in as far as the two different types of testing strategies that were asked about here?
I think, I've so many thoughts and feelings about this.
That's why I made you go first.
So testing, there's a lot of dogma around testing about what kinds of things you should test. And, you know, the core proponents, the original proponents of TDD weren't pushing that this is, you know, everything to everybody. It was, this is one way that works for them. And I think in some communities, in some niches, people are saying, if you're not, you know, writing tests first and for everything, then you're not a professional developer. And that's just horribly wrong and offensive and exclusionary and all kinds of terrible things. Testing in software, I believe, needs to directly address risk. So like any other, you know, part of a large system, there's risks that it's going to fail, right? There's, well, what if my databases disappear? Well, what if this function doesn't return what I expect? And in order to mitigate those risks in your software, you should write tests for something. So if this is a particularly risky part of my software, I'm going to write a bunch of tests to make sure that that risk is much less likely to occur. There's lots of pieces of software that are really low risk. So an example from outside the JavaScript community that I often, you know, poke fun at is in Java, you have to write your own getters and setters for properties. And, you know, most people just auto-generate that stuff. But, like, it's a ton of boilerplate code that's in there. And some places are just methodical that they have to hit 100% code coverage of their testing. In order to hit 100% code coverage, which is ridiculous, they have to write tests for their getters and setters. Getters and setters are not at risk to break. You're not reducing your risk in any way by writing those tests. And in fact, you're increasing the costs of your software because every line of code you write is cost. It is more time and money and complexity and maintenance and trying to, you know, wrap your brain around it. And so every line of code that you write, even if that's test code, is adding to the overall cost of your project. And so don't write tests that don't do anything for you. If it doesn't reduce the risk in some, you know, known interesting way of your project, then why is it there? Now, there's like a little exception to that, right? Is that a lot of the proponents of TDD will say, well, TDD is not so much about the tests. It's about the process of how to build well-structured code. And I totally get that. But that means you don't have to check in the tests when you're done, right? You use TDD to build tests and build code. But when you're done, maybe 90% of those tests, you just delete and you never check in. Because they were part of the process, they're not actually valuable in their own. Particularly for a lot of software, there's a really great conference talk by a gentleman named Gary Bernhardt. And the talk is called Boundaries, and it's out on his website. You can Google it. And he talks about this idea of when you're building a piece of software, there's a conceptual architecture of you have the core of your software, which you can build in a very functional style. It is the main state machine, the main set of things that your app needs to do. And those are really good at being, or you can really address the risk in that core with unit tests. You can, you know, exercise all the different paths and make sure everything works. And TDD and BDD are fantastic mechanisms to improve that. But then all around that core is the shell of interacting with the outside world. It's receiving events. It's talking over networks. It's interacting with databases. It's all of that other shit that you have to do. And that's awful for using unit tests for, because you're going to end up spending so much time mocking out things that you can't really control, that really is questionable about whether or not that's even valuable code. Like, you reduce risk in interacting with the outside world by testing your interactions with the outside world. And so there's these different parts of your code that benefit from different kinds of testing.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said there. I'm not somebody who's used test-driven development very often for a number of reasons, especially on the front. Well, I should qualify that. On the front end, I haven't done that. I don't know whether it's because I consider myself a defensive programmer, right? The second that you come to me with something that you want changed or a new feature, I don't generally get excited right away. I think, all right, how is my user going to hose me on this? How is this going to get ruined? How is this going to get exploited? But the developer in me who is punching keys wants to put something on, get something working first. I want to see something. I want to be able to test something that's there rather than write a bunch of code for this hypothetical thing, right? Because that hypothetical thing could change. And now, you know, it's easy to adjust the thing that you're working on, the actual front end widgetry or whatever, but then to go back and change a bunch of tests now that something's there or a spec has changed, I find that really bothersome, right? So the more UI heavy a given task is, the less I'm going to write tests ahead of time, because these visuals and elements and everything else can change. Behavior-driven development is actually really sort of the fun side for me, where halfway through building something or at the end, you start putting together tests that challenge what you've already written. And I like to see those tests fail, because it means that I figured out a way to outfox myself in what I've built. Like, do you have a specific way of testing your own stuff that you swear by? Like, what sort of What is your go-to? Like, what's your process for testing at TrackJS?
So there's different kinds of testing. There's different parts of our app, and we test them differently. So the one that I can speak to the most is our agent. So the agent code that we put in other people's web pages, that has a really high impact if something goes wrong, being that if we release it and we break a bunch of people's sites, that's really bad.
Right.
And so the impact of something going wrong is quite high, and so we are concerned about that, and we spend a lot of time testing it. And we've more or less followed this idea of a functional core and an imperative shell around it, is that there's a bunch of core functions inside of our agent code that do different state operations. We're adding information to our internal logs, or we're trying to discover certain things about the state or that sort of thing. And we have unit tests around those. And I use Jasmine just because that was a popular library at the time it was created, and there hasn't been really a reason to change it. And I followed TDD in some of those cases of building it, where I would say, I'm defining this function. Here's like the inputs and outputs of the function, and I'm going to write a bunch of unit tests. Now, I strictly never mock anything. I feel like if I have to mock something, I've designed something incorrectly.
Right.
So every one of our unit tests is strictly, I'm going to call this function with these, you know, this series of inputs, and I test that I get these series of outputs, and everything's real simple and straightforward. But the more complicated part about testing is our interactions with the outside world, which in our case is the different browsers. Our agent operates at a very low level. And so every browser difference is actually a huge potential of something to go wrong.
Right.
And so we spend a lot of time using real browser testing, using a Selenium stack, and testing against all of the major browsers and like doing different things, like triggering different kinds of events and sending errors and generating problems on the page, all kinds of different stuff like that, and making sure that we actually work in all of those different browsers, which would be it would be impossible to do that with a unit test. And so we actually have way more browser level testing for the agent than we do unit tests.
Interesting. I knew that when this question came up, you were the perfect guy to answer it, because I knew you'd have a ton to say. And like you said, with your TrackJS agent, there's a lot of exposure there, right? So you have to be super careful. So you've probably written hundreds of tests to make sure everything's good.
Yeah.
So that's like really awesome insight.
One of the things that I see a lot of people talk about with testing is people trying to address the ratios of how many tests you have. Like the very old doctrine is the testing pyramid, which a lot of people talk about, where you have a few system tests, a few more integration tests, and lots of unit tests. Or more recently, I saw something circulating about the testing trophy, which is just a different shape. But like it was still prescribing of like, here's how many of different kinds of tests you should have relative to each other. And I think both of those ideas is just dangerous, is you can't prescribe one kind of pattern of testing for all projects. Every project is different, and you need to think about the risk that that project has and write tests to address those risks. So
absolutely.
Our agent has a ton of risk on browser compatibility. So we have a ton of browser compatibility tests.
Yeah. Risk. I think risk is the key word there. You can't swear by a given testing, strategy until you know where things could break down. And that's why you have to sort of judge one thing at a time. But again, developer, that was a really awesome question. I'm going to shift to another question that we just received. Is there such a thing as minimum amount that every developer should know in JavaScript, regardless of their stack? If so, what would be expected? I have a really quick answer to that, but we're going to expound on it. My really quick answer to that is you need to know enough to either get the job that you want or keep the job that you want, or to be able to build the project that you want. All right. That's like the super short answer. The longer answer, I think my longer answer is one thing that started bugging me when the MooTools jQuery such and such framework started coming out is I feel like JavaScript developers became more snobby, snobby's might not be the best word, but one-uppy, more I know better than you. And that's something that I had always I'd always sort of felt that in server-side languages, but when it crept into JavaScript, that, you know, I'm smarter than you, this is the better way to do it, that sort of thing, I was really put off by it. That being said, what I think that people need to know are the basics of the language, right? You don't need to know how every method works, because I have to look up methods that have been around since day one. But you do want to know basic strategies for doing things. So one example is when I used to interview people, I would ask them, how do you get the child nodes of a DOM node? Right? And that's a fairly obvious, simple question. But I would say, you know, during that time, I would get 70% of people telling me the jQuery method to get it. And that's one of those things where, and I'm not trying to be snobby, but that's sort of, that's like a language thing that people should know, right? I feel like the basics of the language are what you should know. But every job is different, right? Like, I was on MDN and I was doing all, like, JavaScript plus jQuery / front-end code. And then I moved to another position at Mozilla and do Node.js and Service Worker stuff. And now I'm working on React DevTools, right? And React's a skill you need to learn. jQuery is a skill that you need to learn. But if you have, like, the basics of the language down, you're going to be able to move from team to team or job to job and pick up that framework or that methodology pretty quickly. Would you agree?
I don't know. So first, thank you, Heather, for giving us this question, because it's a fantastic question. It goes a lot into subclassing developers and, like, understanding that software development is so much more broad than most of us give credit for. So in, like, this strict question of, is there an amount of JavaScript that every developer should know? No. Most developers, I would say, don't even need to know JavaScript, because most developers probably don't, like, not all developers are web developers. If you're writing embedded code, no, you don't need to know JavaScript. If you are a database developer, you probably don't need to know JavaScript. Like, it's JavaScript people tend to think that, like, we are the whole world and the only kind of software is web software, and it's not. Like, there's so much more to this industry than there is web. Now, if we are talking about web developers, if you are building an application that is going to be delivered as a web page, then there is probably a basic amount of JavaScript you need to know. JavaScript is a core part of this ecosystem. Now, I don't know what it is. Like, as you were describing, like, tell me what the method is to get the child nodes of a DOM node. Honestly, I don't know what that is off the top of my head. I would take that to MDN. Like, I don't know. Like, that's just not something that I've had to do a lot of times in the kind of problems that I solve. And so I don't keep that in resident memory. Like, I've paged it out to MDN and I couldn't just recite it off the top of my head.
To DavidWalsh.name?
Yeah, I've paged it out to DavidWalsh.name, right? I think each of us have, like, a core set of problems that, like, were really painful for us to solve as we were growing up in this industry, for lack of a better word, and we'll retain those tidbits forever. But the whole rest of the space, we don't know. And I think it's okay that we don't know. It's, do you have the ability to, like, look it up?
Not just that, but do you have the curiosity to learn it? I think is also really important as well.
So if you are a web developer, I would say that the basic things that you should know about JavaScript is, one, tell me what JavaScript is for, and two, where is a authoritative source to learn, to find out about JavaScript? Like, if somebody's saying that they know that they're a web developer, I should expect that they can tell me that JavaScript is for programmatically manipulating the front end of the page, or talking asynchronously to servers, or building front-end client-side rendering in response to user actions. Be able to tell me what the use cases are of when I would use JavaScript. And then second, I'd say, all right, if you were to try and figure out how do you get the child nodes of a DOM node, where would you start? And they should either start by saying, I'm going to Google it, I'm going to go to MDN, or I'm going to go to DavidWalsh.name. They should know how to find it, right?
Sure.
I don't necessarily care if they know what it is. Like, they might not, but they should know how to find it. They should know, like, how would they approach it, or what kinds of problems would be appropriate to solve in JavaScript versus what kind of problems might be inappropriate to solve. I think that's the real important part. If we dive into the part about which frameworks you should know and which build tools you should know, I think that's all contextual into what kinds of problems you're solving and,
yeah, 100%.
And what the rest of your team is doing, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. David Walsh, that name first, people. Okay.
So Heather Quick asked a follow-up question of have we lost touch with the vanilla JavaScript language? Like, are there so many tools and frameworks and stuff like that that people don't know the core of JavaScript? I think that's true. I think that's more true in some frameworks than others. Like, I think Angular actually has that problem in spades because they've invented so much of their own stuff that, like, when I talk to a developer and I like, they will even describe themselves as they're an Angular developer, and I'm not immediately convinced that they know JavaScript because I've met so many that, like, that don't know Java. They know Angular. They could write an Angular app, but if you take away Angular, they're not really sure what's left.
I think jQuery suffered from that problem for a long time.
Oh yeah,
right? You know, like, are you a JavaScript developer or a jQuery developer? And that was mostly unfair, right? One thing I have to say about that sort of thing is that I believe that all web developers really want to learn everything as quickly as they can. But the truth of the matter is, if you have a job where you in-house use jQuery, that's what you're going to use, and that's what you're going to spend your time on. And some of the core JavaScript stuff you might have to learn on the side, which seems sort of backwards, but that is the case. The one thing that I would say is that people shouldn't look down on other people with regard to whether they know enough JavaScript. But I also think that if you're...
I think you should have just left it at people shouldn't look down on other people.
Well, there's that, like, too.
Period.
But I would agree that we have lost track of that, especially with, you know, it depends on what the framework of the day is, right? React is super popular. So there are probably people within the React space that describe the same people in the Angular space, right? Who you could say don't know enough core JavaScript, right? But it's all contextual. It's like anything else, right? If you really want to know something, if you really want to learn something, you'll find the time to do it.
And we learn what we need to do to get our jobs done, to make the thing that we want to achieve. We just take the shortest path, and there's nothing wrong with that. Like, if the shortest path for you to accomplish your goal is to use Angular and just to use Angular and get it out the door and be done, there's nothing wrong with that. Right. But like, is there a core that every JavaScript developer needs to know kind of thing in terms of the technologies and the APIs? Probably not.
No.
Because we can accomplish the same thing in so many different ways.
Exactly. Thanks for that question, Heather. That was great. All right. Last up, I saved the fun one for last, but I get asked this question all the time. How do you handle work-life balance and prevent burnout? Do you want to go first or should I?
Well, I don't prevent burnout. I just burn out in a blaze of glory and rage quit and be angry on Twitter. But I don't think that's the answer anybody was looking for.
Well, I mean, it was short and sweet. I used to be really, really bad at this. Really bad. And it sort of... the whole idea of work-life balance hit me when I had kids, right? Like, even when I was married, I could spend a bunch of time on the weekend working, and I never really burnt out, especially at Mozilla, because I loved what I was doing. But I have a blog post that I wrote that gets a lot of attention still now, called Being a Dev Dad. And it sort of described my journey from being this guy who just worked all the time, and when he was done with work, he would, like, code his blog and everything else, to needing to be there for somebody and needing to be away from the computer at a certain point, right? And so I can offer a few tips here. Actually, let me describe my day really briefly. Get up, get the kids ready for daycare slash school, make their lunch, hugs, kisses, all that stuff. Take a quick shower, and then I try and hit work, so to speak, at 9 o'clock. When 5 o'clock comes around, it's a hard done. My office has no lights in it. So I'm not supposed to be here after. Well, you know, 5 o'clock in the winter for us is pretty dark, but once it gets to summer, I don't need those lights. But done by five, spend the rest of the night with family. And that's what it is. How have I made being at work better? Here's a tip that I sort of found for myself a long time ago, is that if you make your work time feel like rec time, you're going to be a lot happier. So there's a number of things that I do, right? There can be, you know, a lot of people listen to music, that's fine. But what I do is, next to my computer, apparently it's not here now, I have an Xbox remote, and or an Xbox controller, I should say. And I always like to play video games. So I'll just have it next to me when I'm thinking and trying to burn through something, or I'm getting annoyed with work. I just tinker around with it a little bit, press some buttons, pretend there's some headshots flying around. And like, that makes my work day more enjoyable, so that I don't get burnt out as fast, right? And needing to be there for people that need me is like just a great way to get away from the computer and avoid burnout. Now, I'm not telling people they should go out and have a couple kids, right? That's not the right thing to do. But set a hard start and stop for yourself so that you can avoid burning out and being on the computer too long.
I think that's a great tip. There was, when I was going to school and working, I did the same thing. Like I had like defined like time boxes of when I was going to do things. So like, these are my work hours and I worked during those. And then these are my school hours and I did school during those hours. And then outside of that was my family time. And I didn't work and I didn't do it school during that time. And so that definitely helped me. Right now in my life, everything's a little fluid and I kind of doing everything all at the same time. It's working so far. I don't really have any good advice to share about that though.
Are you in a permanent state of burnout? Is that why it's
it could be
as much?
It could just be that I'm perpetually burnt and that I'm just working through the burnt right now. I don't really know. I've been basically working a lot for the last 6 years of my life, and I don't know how to not do that.
See, that was my issue, right? Here's what I would do. Before I had kids, I was started out at a job I didn't like, right? So you get up and you do the 8 to 5 or whatever. And then I come home and I'd hit the computer. And I was fine with that because working and coding was something I was good at, and it's something that I enjoyed. And even on Saturdays, dude, I was sitting on the couch, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, noon, 1, 2, 3, watching soccer, writing blog posts, coding. It was crazy stuff. I loved it all. But getting away from that, you know, like you said, you've been just working really hard and it's just been the steady thing. Getting away from that was really hard for me, really hard. So that's when I needed to set all these rules. And I think it's turned out for the best. I'll also add that giving your wife a glass of wine after the kids are in bed earns you a little bit of leniency to write a blog post or two. That's also worked for me. That keeps me out of trouble.
Good. So caring for the others in your life and giving them what they need.
That's what opened my eyes and helped me to avoid burnout.
I like it. Well, I think that's the questions we had for today. I think it was a pretty good show. What do you think? What was your big takeaway today?
My big takeaway is going to be a lot about testing. I think that testing is something, coming back to front end over the past few months, is something that I haven't thought a lot about. I think that my general philosophy behind testing matches yours in as far as risk, but I'm going to start looking at the tasks that I complete from a testing perspective before I start them. And I think that maybe that'll lead me somewhere to being a better developer or writing better code. How about you?
I like that you and I both agreed that the TC39 should just do what MooTools did.
Just flatten it, baby.
Yeah, I like it. I think they should do it. I think they should listen to us. Flatten means flat.
My other takeaway is that you were wrong about prototypes, but I think that we'll save that.
We'll have to agree to disagree about that one.
I will fight you on that.
All right. Well, we are going to do another Q&A show, I'm sure, again soon. So if you want us to, you know, banter about your questions, feel free to send them to us on Twitter. I'm Todd H. Gardner, and my co-host is at David Walsh Blog. We don't know what our topic is for next week yet. So if you have ideas, please shoot them our way. Until then, I'm Todd Gardner.
I'm David Walsh. Have a good week, guys.
Adios.
Script and Style Show is recorded and produced by David Walsh and Todd Gardner. We'll see you next time on Script and Style.